Welcome to Open Your Eyes, a podcast about empowering each of us with the perspective and tools to grow and change. You know, here at Open Your Eyes, we're deeply committed to the simple truth that you can't be what you can't see. Therefore, we need to open our eyes to the possibilities and realities all around us. And one of those realities is that you are filled with immense potential. So sometimes seeing things in a new way can help unlock that potential. So today, wherever you are as you listen to this podcast, I hope you get a new perspective of how you can think and live better. And do us a huge favor. When you're done listening today, share this link with a friend. It just may be what they need to hear in their life today. Let's get started. You know, in life, we've all had circumstances or things that we wish hadn't happened. Maybe mistakes we wish we hadn't made. And we look back and wonder why, and we replay these things in our mind, and these things can tend to define us. So today, I'd like to talk about the healthy attitude that says, I wouldn't change a thing. Viola Davis was born on her grandmother's farm in South Carolina called Singleton Plantation. Her parents had married very young. Her brother, her first child, was born when her mother was only 15, and the couple went on to have five more children. Her father was an alcoholic, unfaithful, and often abusive to his wife and six children. Well, not long after Viola was born, her parents left three children in South Carolina and took the other three children, including Viola, to Rhode Island. There, her father trained horses and her mother worked as a maid. The family lived in abject poverty with a lot of dysfunction. Their apartments were rat infested and often condemned. Her parents fought and her mother was beaten often. Viola endured poverty, hunger, sexual abuse, and domestic violence. The children in her young life were cruel. She said 8 or 9 boys in her class made it their end of school day ritual to chase her home like dogs hunting prey, yelling abusive slurs, and every day was the same madness as she ran home with the same trauma. Well, years later, Viola would write, "A conversation I had on the set of Suicide Squad with Will Smith was an aha moment. Will asked me, 'Viola, who are you? What does that mean?' 'I know who I am,' I replied with indignant confidence. He asked again, 'No, but who are you?' 'Well, what does that mean?' I asked again. 'Look, I'm always going to be that 15-year-old boy whose girlfriend broke up with him. That's always going to be me,' he said. 'So who are you?' 'Who am I?' I was quiet. And once again, that indestructible memory hit me. Then I just blurted out, 'I'm the little girl who would run home after school every day in the third grade because these boys hated me, because I was not pretty, because I was black.' Will stared at me as if seeing me for the first time and just nodded. My throat got tight and I could feel the tears welling up. Memories are immortal. They're deathless and precise. They can strangle you and define you, but they also have the power of giving you joy and perspective in hard times." Davis would write, "One of the many defining memories of my dad is when I was 14. My baby sister, Danielle, was about 1.5 years old. Well, my mom and dad were fighting. I never knew about what. Most of the time, these fights just started because my dad wanted to vent. They were facing each other, screaming, and my dad picked up a glass. I grabbed my sister, Danielle, with one arm and put my other arm between my parents, willing them to stop. With my arm between them, I was gently saying, 'Please, Daddy, stop.' It didn't work. 'Tell me I won't bust your head open, me Alice. Tell me I won't,' he said. Then he swung his hand and smashed the glass on the side of my mom's head, and I saw the glass slice the upper side of her face near her eye, and blood just squirted out, a lot of blood. I couldn't anymore. I just couldn't passively stand by as he lifted his hand to swing again. I yelled, 'Stop. You just stop right now, Daddy. Give me the glass. Give it to me.' I saw my hand shaking uncontrollably. My heart was in my throat. I was immersed in fear. He stood staring at my mom, wanting to swing again. My dad never looked at me. He kept his hand gripped on the glass, staring at my mom, his eyes bloodshot, wanting so bad to hit her again. I screamed, 'Give it to me.' screaming as if the louder I became, the more my fear would be realized. He gave me the glass and walked away. I took the glass and hit it, and my body felt like I had just been beaten up or ran 30 miles. I had to stand up to my father, the authority figure. He should be taking the glass from me and teaching me right from wrong. The most frightening figure in my life and the first man we all ever loved. As much as I wanted my life to be better, the only tools I had to navigate the world were given to me by my parents. How they talked, how they fought, how my mom made concessions, how they loved, and how they shaped me. If I didn't bust out of all that, would this exhaustion and depletion be what I would feel after every fight in my life? That fight marked the beginning of my shift. Looking back on that night when I stood up to my dad and wiped up my mom's blood, I knew my life would be a fight, and I realized this, I had it in me. Well, there are more stories from Viola's childhood that I could share here, but I know her life was awful in many ways. But things changed when Viola saw a movie with Cicely Tyson. She felt like Cicely was reaching through the screen and offering a hand to Viola. So, not long after, Viola and her sisters performed in a contest at a local park, and they won. And Viola felt like somebody. Drawn to be an actress, young Viola enrolled in an acting class at Upward Bound, and she continued her transformation. One day after class, Viola was talking to her friends and made the comment that she wasn't pretty. Her teacher, Ron, stopped and emphatically said, "What are you talking about? You're beautiful. Don't you see it?" Ron also told her that theater awakens the mind's ability to create ideas and images that she never had before. And Viola wanted even more to be an actor because it was a healing wellspring to her. She said, "When I was acting, I felt everything. Every last receptor in my body was alive, 100% alive, and I wasn't hiding anything." Well, her passion took her from Central Falls High School to the arts program at Rhode Island College to Juilliard School of Performing Arts. And for many years, Viola acted in various roles on and off Broadway. Then she got parts in a number of films. But in 2011 came the biggest break of her career when she starred in the movie Help. She would win 2 Screen Actors Guild Awards for the film and a Golden Globe nomination. In that movie, Davis played a housemaid in Tennessee. Davis described her performance in the film as channeling her mother, saying, "I feel like I brought my mom to life. I channeled her spirit. I channeled the spirit of my grandmother, and I've kind of paid homage to how they contributed to my life and the lives of so many people." Now, you have to wonder if the biggest acting moment in Viola's career, perhaps her best performance in her career, happened because she had the experiences she had as a young child. Without these experiences, her ability to play that role in The Help would have been significantly different. Well, Davis went on to play in other hit movies, and today she earns millions from her appearances. But Viola writes, "Every painful memory, every mentor, every friend and foe as a child served as a leap pad that has shaped me. The imperfect but blessed sculpture that is Viola is still growing and being chiseled, but I am no longer ashamed of me." She says, in a sense, it was the tough things that happened in her childhood that made her who she is today. And I wonder if she could choose to do it again, knowing that the outcome was dependent on those difficulties that she faced, if she would again choose her childhood. And I have a sense, after reading her life story, that she would. That's how it is with life sometimes. It's the hard things we experience, the trials, that give us the strength or perspective or will to do what we need to later in life. So if that's the case, then what about you and me? Do we need to turn some of the bad or unfortunate things that have happened to us into strength to do something remarkable today? One famous person wrote, "In order to love who you are, you must not hate the experiences that shaped you." And I think that's true. I've had experiences that when I think about them, I cringe or I get a pit in my stomach reliving them. I wish I had acted differently or said something different or known better. I wish I had had more wisdom or maturity or whatever to have prevented me from doing what I did. But as much as I want, I can't change where I've been. But what I can do is learn from those things and appreciate what I did learn. And when I do, when I thank God for these things, it seems to take the pain away and it gives me room, space to give myself a break and realize that I'm not perfect, but trying to do better each day. Carl Jung said, "I'm not what happened to me. I am what I choose to become." And Viola Davis is a perfect example of this. When we hate our past, we often disassociate from the parts of ourselves that the past created, or perhaps the empathy or grit or resilience we gained from it. And it takes a bit of work to love ourselves, even the past self with all of its scars and shadows. Psychiatrist Viktor Frankl, the famous Holocaust survivor, offers critical insight into this idea. In his landmark book, Man's Search for Happiness, he wrote, "When we're no longer able to change the situation, we're challenged to change ourselves." Frankl believed that even the most horrific experiences could become meaningful if a person could find purpose within them. This doesn't mean endorsing or romanticizing suffering, but rather recognizing that meaning can be extracted from pain, and that this meaning can shape a person into someone they admire. Modern psychology affirms this through the concept of post-traumatic growth. Studies show that many people who endure hardships emerge with increased empathy, greater appreciation for life, and stronger personal relationships. They don't love the trauma itself, but they cease to hate it once they see what it made possible. Author Brené Brown teaches that owning your story is an act of courage and a prerequisite for wholehearted living. She writes, "When we deny our stories, they define us. When we own our stories, they get to write a brave new ending." When we refuse to hate the experiences that shaped us, we begin to reclaim authorship of our own narrative. We stop being the victim of a story and become its editor, so to speak. This shift changes not only how we feel about ourselves, but how we engage with the world. Instead of hiding our wounds, we begin to understand them as signs of having lived and grown. In order to love who we are today, we must not hate the experiences that shaped us. In his first year of college, David got caught up in the party scene. He skipped classes, ignored deadlines, and eventually failed out. His parents were furious, and he was ashamed. For a year, he worked construction, grueling, early mornings, harsh weather, but it sobered his perspective. He realized he had taken his opportunities for granted, and eventually he reapplied to a local community college, paid his own way, and finished with honors. Now in his 30s, David runs a successful construction firm and mentors young men who are one mistake away from throwing away their futures. David used to hate the version of himself that wasted time and money. Now he sees it as the time when he learned accountability and grit, and he says, "That failure gave me a fire I never had before." What about you? Was there a mistake or something that happened to you that you wish would not have happened? And as you look back on that mistake, can you see how it shaped you in your life and the decisions that you've made? Howard Schultz grew up in a poor housing project in Brooklyn, New York. His father worked low-wage, unstable jobs with no benefits. And one winter, when Howard was 7, his father slipped on the ice, broke his ankle, and was fired because he couldn't work. There was no workers' comp, no insurance, and no support. And Howard remembers his father as angry and bitter and defeated by the world, a man who never found dignity in his work. Well, that early experience haunted Howard. He promised himself that if he ever had the chance to build something, he would treat his employees differently than his father had been treated. And years later, after working his way through college and entering the business world, he joined a small Seattle coffee company, Starbucks. And when Schultz eventually bought and expanded Starbucks, he did so with a unique philosophy. He offered all employees, including part-timers, health benefits and stock options. It was virtually unheard of at the time. He also insisted the stores be designed in a way that gave people a sense of connection and community, something his own upbringing lacked. And Starbucks grew into a global company, but at its heart was Howard's original pain. He took a childhood experience of powerlessness and turned it into a mission to building something better for himself and others. And Schultz has said, "I wanted to build the kind of company my father never had a chance to work for." He doesn't glamorize his childhood, but he no longer resents it. It shaped his values, his leadership, and the soul of the company he created. So if you were coaching a teenager or your adult children about how to turn something from their past into something good for their future, what would be the things you would teach? Well, here's a few suggestions. First, think about those times honestly. Whether it's trauma, loss, betrayal, don't minimize the experience, but think about it with compassion for yourself and others. Next, seek the wisdom in the wound. What did this experience teach you? What part of your strength and insight or empathy exists because of it? What would be missing in your life if it hadn't occurred? And be thankful for it. Third, change the narrative. Shift from a story of "this ruined me" to "this shaped me." Rewriting doesn't mean falsifying it. It means adding layers of meaning to it. Next, forgive when ready. Forgiveness, especially of oneself, is a profound act of release. Even when others are not sorry, we can still choose to free ourselves from the hate we direct towards them. Fifth, practice integration, not rejection. Integrate the experience into your story and life. The goal is not to be someone in spite of what happened, but someone because of it. And I wonder if this is how God feels about our mistakes. It hurts that you had the experience, but it's there for you to learn from. So use that learning to become more like Him and set your feet on a new, more informed path. Sometimes we get to thinking so much about our mistakes that they become part of us, part of our decision-making in a negative way, rather than being fuel for our learning and turning it to our good. In the early 1600s, John Howland was an English indentured servant who was part of the Separatist Pilgrims. And many people think that the Pilgrims came to America in search of religious freedom. And that may be true in part. But before coming to America, the Pilgrim Separatists fled to Holland. There they had religious freedom. But they didn't like the lack of morals they found in the people there. And they were mostly working as laborers, living in small quarters, living in poverty. This way of life was not at all what they expected. Here they were seeking a better life, and what they found in Leiden, Netherlands was not acceptable in many ways. Was it a mistake to move there? Maybe. But the mistake gave them greater clarity about taking the next risk, the extreme risk to move to the new world. Now it's thought that before they came to the Americas, John Howland returned to England to secure investments and charter the ships called Speedwell and Mayflower for the voyage. When the Speedwell proved unseaworthy, they all crowded into the Mayflower. The Mayflower departed Plymouth, England on September 16, 1620, and the small 100-foot ship had 102 passengers and a crew of about 40, extremely cramped conditions. By the second month out, the ship was being buffeted by strong westerly gales, causing the ship's timbers to be badly shaken, with the caulking falling out, with seawater leaking in to the passenger berths. This, combined with a lack of proper rations and unsanitary conditions for several months, contributed to extreme sickness on all of the passengers. Well, during the voyage, there was a turbulent storm, during which Howland fell overboard. He managed to grab a rope from a small sail that was trailing in the water and was hauled back aboard safely. His rescuing would prove to be a miracle of sorts, in that he would later be the secretary to Governor Carver and would play a key role in assuming the colony's debt to England, and he also signed the Mayflower Compact, founding the colony. He would go on to fill one important role after another and outlive every man on the Mayflower but one. As he looked back on his fall from the Mayflower, he could see the providence in grabbing the trailing rope. And had he not found the rope, he would likely have been lost. And this loss would have impacted you and me, because among his descendants are Presidents George Bush and Franklin Roosevelt, Ralph Waldo Emerson, Supreme Court Justice Jackson, actors Alec Baldwin, Humphrey Bogart, John Lithgow, Christopher Lloyd, and Chevy Chase, and writer Jane Austen. Here's my point. You and I may fall off life's ship, so to speak. We may make mistakes and fall in our life, but God usually has a trailing line waiting for us to grab. And if we do, if we're humble and we seek to learn from our falling, not only will our life, but our children's lives likely benefit from who we become because of what we learned from our fallings and failings. In the scripture, Peter describes our life. He describes us as pilgrims. We, like pilgrims coming to America, are very much strangers, trying to find who we really are. We are like them, the pilgrims, seeking a homeland, a citizenship, a better way of living. And that better way of living can be found in setting aside the thinking and condemning we do of ourselves and each other in the failings and fallings we've had in life. Years ago, I was a speaker and spoke about the concept of embracing your flaws to make you more powerful. And one example I often gave was that of a golf ball. If the golf ball was smooth, it would fly through the air, leaving a big wake of air around it. And this is called pressure drag. And this would slow down the ball significantly. But a golf ball has dimples, dents, flaws in the smoothness of the sphere. These dimples rough up the air around the ball, and this accelerates the airflow over the ball. And this pressure difference gives the ball lift, allowing it to fly farther and higher and faster. The flaws in the ball also allow it to be steered more easily. So, likewise, embrace your dents and the circumstances of the past that you wish were different, because in your life, who knows if these things make you go higher, faster, and further. Sarah Thomas, an American swimmer, dove into the English Channel to set a new record that no one had ever done before, man or woman. The record was to swim the English Channel 4 times without stopping. Most remarkable was, Thomas made the decision to swim 1 year earlier while she was in the middle of treatment for breast cancer. At age 35, she was diagnosed with very aggressive breast cancer, and her treatment included chemo, radiation, and surgery. She lost her hair, her strength, and her ability to swim a normal workout, and she needed something, a goal, to pull her through what was her biggest challenge of her life and career. So, she set the goal to swim the English Channel 4 times. Now, this is an incredibly hard thing to do. The distance is a total of 81 miles, but because of the strong currents, you can't swim a straight line, so the swim is much, much longer. The water temperature is around 60 degrees, and Sarah knew she'd be in the water for more than 2 days, maybe 3, to set the record. She couldn't leave the water or come in contact with the boat or any human. She could receive food and water and medication from a basket. At age 37, following her treatment, her body wasn't in the best condition, and Sarah was heavier than she'd ever been, and her life was a bit in turmoil, but she set her sights on the swim and started training. On the day of the swim, she entered the water, attempting the impossible. Through the nights and shifts in tides and currents, she swam. 3 times across the channel, she swam, but as she started the final leg, she was vomiting from swallowing too much seawater. Her tongue was swollen and raw from the salt water, and she was hallucinating. She finished at 6:30 a.m. after a night of dark, windy, choppy conditions. Most remarkable is looking at the actual satellite map of her swim. As the crow flies, her swim would have been, as I mentioned, 80 or so miles. But because of the currents and tides, her swim was much longer. In fact, it ended up being 50 miles longer because of her swimming against the tide. Now, if you look at her swim path, it looks like a huge S rather than a straight line. It looks a lot like our path in life. Our paths are rarely straight. Rarely do great things happen without currents, tides, jellyfish stings, mistakes, and other things in our life. Sarah said, "Just wanted to show that cancer didn't define me, that I was still strong and I was still capable." She also said without having gone through cancer, she would have not had the strength to complete the swim. It was the worst thing that happened to her in cancer that gave her the ability to do the best thing she would do in swimming. She described her cancer experience as a way to lose herself and find herself at the same time. So, as we end today, maybe you could take a few minutes and consider how your past circumstances have defined you, and also consider how you are stronger and a better person as a result, and even think of your life differently, in a good way, because you went through what you went through, and maybe even say thank you to heaven for what you now know as a result, and watch. You may just feel like I do, that even though these things happened in your life and caused you pain and suffering, you wouldn't change it because you are who you are as a result. Most of all, thanks for being here today. And don't forget to join us next week for another episode as we seek to open our eyes to who and what we can become.